You're listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast, recorded at the BVA headquarters with your hosts, Kevin Miller and Tommy Ahlquist. Each episode is focused on shedding new light on different perspectives to create dialogue that inspires excellence.
And welcome to the Inspire Excellence Podcast. Tommy Ahlquist, Kevin Miller. Tommy, we're talking today about some serious topics, some inspirational topics, and some issues that a lot of people kind of shuffle under the table, sir.
Yeah, Kevin, you know, we have lots of different guests on here. I think a lot of variety. In fact, the feedback we get is people like the variety. We talk about business. We talk about sports. We talk about a lot of things in life that bring people joy and inspire them in other ways. And today we've got a guest that we've wanted to have on for a while, and I'm very, very thankful that he's here. Jason Coombs, who's the CEO of Brick House Recovery, has his own recovery story, an addiction to opioids, and was able to meet him along the campaign trail. And what I'll say about Jason is my intro to him, and then we'll talk about what he's doing. But this opioid crisis and just general addiction that we're facing in our nation and in our state and in families and all the way down to the individual level, it is a crisis. I think it's finally, you know, you look at what President Trump's doing since he's been elected, and I think you're hearing more about it now, which I think is very, very good. But as a physician, being part of that problem, right? I was an ER doctor, and you saw what was happening with these, you know, Percocet and Vicodin and Norcos and the treatment of pain and just how addictive they were on people, and how hard it has been to fix this problem and how it just devastates lives and families. So along that, as the background, I meet Jason. Oh, this guy, I mean, I know we call this Inspire Excellence, Kevin. This guy's inspiring. It didn't just take this as, hey, it's a problem, but it's his mission in life to help and give back to others. We were just talking about before the podcast of how he's doing all this. But I can't wait, Jason, to hear from you today and hear where you are on the journey of scaling your rescue that you're providing for people out there. So Jason Coombs, thank you for being here today. And maybe we can start with you just, can you tell our listeners who may be a different audience, just a little bit about you?
Yeah. And I truly am honored to be a guest on this particular podcast. And it's so nice to rub shoulders with you and what you're both doing. it's safe to say that, although this might be a different audience, addiction is affecting everybody. It crosses economic classes. It crosses all lines. These days, the stigma is being dismantled, which is part of my mission, and bringing awareness to the point that this is affecting lives. It's also affecting our economy. Did you know that chemical dependency costs our nation $700 billion per year on healthcare costs, loss of productivity, and Department of Corrections, criminal justice costs? That's a big number. And so even just to the entrepreneur who may or may not have something or somebody close to them that's affected, it affects the economy, and which affects business and affects policy, and you know, by way of introduction, my story that led me into being here today and this rescue cause that you're talking about and what I'm all about, what I'm trying to do today, you know, that was a bit of a blindside after a car accident. Simply getting introduced to the wrong doctor who was running a drug ring, and ultimately getting hooked on Oxycontin. My life started to circle the drain. Once he got busted, felonies came, and I found myself homeless, and I found myself divorced, and lost it all. And I was really, really but not only was I caught up in this mess with the hooks of addiction in me, but I couldn't control all of the relationships that were just falling apart. And that was difficult. But through the process of getting sober and learning about the impact that this illness and this disease has across lines has really evoked this purpose in my life, because for a while I thought that I just squandered, you know, 10, 15 years of my life. And now I see that as, no, that was my research. That was what put me in this position so that I could now have empathy for those that are suffering and be a guide to them.
That's great. So I'm not going to let you off the hook here. Lots of people go through that and have addiction as part of their life, but you truly have embraced this mission. So tell us a little bit about Brick House and what you do there and what you've learned through that process and what resources. I mean, there are people out there that do. What I love about what you've started is people listening today. It may be a family member. It may be people listening today that have a problem. But talk to us a little bit about Brick House and what's out there. And then I do want to get into your book. You've just started a book tour, Unhooked, How to Help an Addicted Loved One Recover. And so I want you to maybe, because I think it's pretty special what you're doing with your passion and your mission to go rescue and help others. So delve into that a little bit for us.
Absolutely. I can't speak about Brick House Recovery without telling the Genesis story. Back when I was about 72 days sober, I got a job selling hot dogs out in front of a hardware store down in Salt Lake City. And I was offered $6 an hour plus tips. And that was what I was doing for a living as a college graduate. And it was quite humiliating. And so each day it was a grind to get through. And it was the summer, it was hot, and I was standing by a grill, mustard stains on my shirt, you know, pretty low in my life. But I was happy because I was sober and I had a lot to hold my head up about. There was one customer that came up to the grill who asked me how my day was, and I began to tell him, and the classic addict overshare in early recovery, I just began to tell him my whole story. And all he did was ask me how my day was. And I was like, oh, my day is great. I'm 72 days sober. Just got out of rehab. It was my fifth rehab.
He's like, whoa, I just wanted mustard. Right. It's a mustard. Yeah.
That's exactly what it was. And because there's this filter problem for people that get sober, and we deal and face that all the time with my clients. But it's kind of a funny thing. But as I was sharing with him my story, he stopped and in his tracks, and he asked me a real heartfelt question, because his son was struggling with addiction, and he asked what he could do to help. And I was in a perfect position to give him my experience and the experience that my parents went through as well, and what they did that worked and what they did that didn't work. And you should have seen him just soak it up. It was like I was for once useful. Like I had some value that I could offer, particularly around a topic that, if you Google addiction help, you get this big mess of opinions and people trying to sell you stuff, and you don't know what's good and what's not. But in that moment, I was able to help this guy, and we spent probably 45 minutes talking, and it was that one experience that ignited this purpose that I have today. It inspired me to take that message and flesh it out and learn how I can be a better communicator. And so I pursued a master's degree in professional communications, and some of my work and my research and my thesis was all around this original version of the book that we'll get to, which was, you know, at that point, I think it was 5 keys to help an addict get sober or something like that. And I began this work of fleshing it out and writing out my experiences and my parents' experiences. And then I would test it. I would take it out and give it away to the moms and the spouses that were calling me saying, how do I help my addicted loved one recover? How do I help? And I got so tired of telling the same things over and over and over, that just wrote it out and I started handing it out. And if I'd say to him, if you really want my advice, you'll read this first and then call me with questions. And so that's the genesis of my purpose. And back to Brick House, I really wasn't planning on opening up an addiction treatment center. I had actually started in the industry after my hot dog job. I got a couple of other jobs in the industry, and I worked for Dr. Kevin McCauley, who is the co-founder for Institute for Addiction Study. I was under his mentorship and learned a ton from him and Dr. Corey Rich. And then I left the industry after I got my master's degree, and I pursued a position with a finance company out in Southern California. And so I went out there and I was working my butt off, and it was a grind, but I was enjoying it. But one day I was out on the beach at Huntington Beach, and I got the news that two of my close friends that week overdosed and died from opiates, two of them in 1 week. And so I was in a bit of a depression that day on the beach, and I was staring out at the waves, and I still remember the scene, and the sun was dancing on the water, and it was warm, and it was like a perfect day, but I was low, and I was asking that big question, like, am I on path? Am I supposed to be doing this with my life? Should I be working in this finance industry, or should I be doing something else with my time? Should I be trying to help people not die from opiate overdose? Because I can help people. I have that expertise. I don't know how much expertise I have in finance, but I can definitely help people get sober and teach them how to stay sober. And that moment was huge for me, because that big question that I was asking, and I was doing some praying, I'm a believer, and I began to receive some inspiration that, no, I wasn't on path, and I needed to do something else with my time. I turned over to my wife, Brynn, and I said, what do you think if we just quit our jobs? We left all this, and we just opened up a drug rehab somewhere to help people. And I thought she would just balk at it, but she actually said, sounds like an adventure. What do we got to lose? Like, are you serious? And she said, let's do it. And so we started to talk about, and that's when we met Dave Pinneger, and we met some people, and you've met Dave. And he said, you need to check out Boise, because I'm getting calls all the time from Boise wanting treatment. And I live in Idaho Falls, and they can't drive across the state because he owns a center over there. And long story short, that is how Brick House Recovery came about, is we literally quit our jobs, packed up our truck, and drove up to Boise. We have no family up here. We just felt like this would be a good place to do it. And in 2014, Brick House Recovery was born. Pretty cool.
That's an amazing story.
Boy, talk about faith. Faith in what you believe in. Jason, what don't we believe, or I'm sorry, what don't we get about the opioid crisis? Locally, Channel 6 and Channel 9 have dedicated a year to covering opioid addiction. 60 Minutes recently did a piece on fentanyl, how people are just dying in the Midwest. You know, these drugs are so dangerous that they had it sealed, and they had a medical guy on staff just in case something happened. These are dangerous drugs. What don't we get about the dangers today as opposed to when we were kids 20 or 30 years ago? Still dangerous drugs. Heroin and the like, but today, is it at a different level that the general public doesn't understand?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot that the general public does not know. And that is that it's not like one year in 2006, everybody just decided to jump on opiates. And that's where you see these huge spikes in overdose, and you see these huge spikes in chemical dependency, particularly around opiates. It wasn't like that. What was going on were these rings like the one I mentioned that I got caught up in. So there were 300 patients seeing this one doctor, and all of them were getting prescriptions of 120 OxyContin per month. And you think about that and you do the math, and then you know how many are being pumped into the market just from one single physician. And when you have multiple physicians doing that and they're all dirty, not all physicians are dirty. I meant in the drug world that, that are doing these rings. And at that time, they didn't have systems in place to monitor very well. So people could go to one doctor and get a script, and then they could go to another doctor and get another script, and those doctors don't know any different. And that was the case for me. And so the story was that a pharmacist heard two individuals talking about this ring in line at the pharmacy, how they were going to go and sell these pills on the streets. And the pharmacist blew the whistle, and the insurance fraud division got a hold of it. They put together a task force to research it. And they not only dismantled and raided this one ring that I was in, but multiple were shut down after that. And so where do 300 patients who are strung out on OxyContin go the minute that their supplier gets shut down? They're going to go hunt on the black market. And on the black market, the prices skyrocketed to $100 a pill. That's why I drained my 401k. I started to pawn my wedding ring, my wife's wedding ring. I was stealing from my parents because the price was so high. And the cartels caught wind of that. And so they start pumping in black tar heroin into the valley and into the cities. And they're just cashing out because at that point, I have to feed this addiction and I can't afford Oxy anymore. I can't do it the old way. I got to go to the streets. And that's where you start to see all the dirty stuff come into the market and you see the overdosing going on. My first shot of heroin, I overdosed and I was brought back to life. And that was eye-opening to me of how potent this stuff is. And so that's why we see these numbers spike. But I think the ball started to roll years and years and years prior to us like catching on to what was really going on. And it was coming through channels of prescriptions and doctors writing those prescriptions.
Maybe just one other quick comment. I think the pharmacology behind opiates is also super important for listeners to know, because it the way your receptors in your body work with an opioid is that a little satisfies those receptors and then they immediately upregulate. So whether you're getting medication for a recent back surgery or whether you've been taking it for a long time, there is no end to those receptors upregulating. You just always need more. So you'll have different categories of patients that get hooked. Some have a back surgery and then just never get off and need more and more and more and more. Some start it illegally and need more and more and more, but whatever the reason you started taking it, you will need more. That's the one thing that's consistent. So, and because of the receptor upregulation, when you try to stop, it's almost impossible without help. It's just almost impossible because your receptors now, you have so many of them that it's not like you can just stop without some sort of help or assistance. So in my opinion, then the other thing that happened, I trained in the 90s, and I remember distinctly having lecture after lecture as a resident in the ER that, hey, we under-treat pain. There was a big push in the country then, and whether it was drug companies or whether it was, I don't know the exact source, but I know that I was trained that we should treat pain adequately in the ER. So it was very usual for me to be told by my attending physicians, no, give them 50, give them 60, give them 70, Norco or hydrocodone to go home with a couple refills, because if they hurt their ankle, they're going to need it. Well, that's just how I was trained, right? I didn't know I was doing anything wrong. It was what I did. So I think you look at the 90s and then the early 2000s, and then all of a sudden they said, hey, there's a problem. Now going a step further, what happened in Idaho is now they took Vicodin or hydrocodone and made it a triplicate by prescription. It was just a lot harder to get. So in the middle of us as doctors prescribing too much of this. Now we make it harder to get, of course, illegal use, whether that's buying them on the street or going to heroin replaces that. So I think that that wave of how things happen exacerbated the problem. And now I think we're finally getting attention to it. So I'm glad we're talking about it too. I mean, I know in just my little circle of family members and really close friends of several that over the last several years have been hooked on medication. And it's been good that we're actually able to talk to it a little bit more. Do you think the stigma is going away a little bit? Where do you think we are in the cycle of understanding? And what are your hopes that the trends that continue, or where are we still falling short?
Yeah, I do think that the stigma is changing because more and more folks, particularly public figures and celebrities, are coming forward and talking about their bouts with chemical dependency, substance use disorder, which normalizes a little bit, which not that we want to normalize addiction, but in the sense that knowing that the disease of substance use disorder seems to grow in secrecy and in darkness. And so if you can't feel comfortable talking to someone about it, you just continue to fuel that. Just like any addiction, it grows in secrecy and darkness. But bringing that to light has been huge for me, but I'm seeing more and more of that happening on the bigger scale. And I can say that, as you just to mention on the pharmacology piece, that it's really fascinating to me that there are folks like my wife who might take a pain pill after a surgery or after having a child or something, and there's actually a reaction of this. I don't like that. Like, I don't want any more of this. So they don't continue to consume. And then there's this other camp of individuals who take it and they might be able to control it, but the more that they do use, then they become dependent. And then there's a third camp, which I'm in, which it's that first pill, I literally had an abnormal reaction to ingesting that pill, the euphoria, my whole body tingled, like it was something that I needed and wanted and continued to obsess about. And so I think that's really fascinating, just on how people react to the drug. But when you have that insatiable craving and you know that you can go to this doctor and get one, and then you can go to that doctor and get one, and go to that doctor and get one, and get it all legally, because back then that's how it was. You could get multiple prescriptions, and I didn't know that was doctor shopping. I didn't even know what that was. I just figured this guy's only giving me 30. This guy's only giving me 120. This guy will give me another 40 to tie me over, you know? And I think we're getting more educated about that, and more systems and fences are being put up around that, which is so needed. And now that the opiate crisis is, and the epidemic is raising awareness, I think doctors are scaling back what they used to prescribe was to treat pain. And Dr. McCauley actually validates everything you're saying, because he went through medical school and he said, all they trained us on, in fact, he wrote the foreword of the book. You can read this part in there. He said, all they trained us on was, you got to treat the patient's pain. Don't hold back. Treat it, and give them the meds that they need so that they can get back to work or get back to this and that. What they didn't know was what was going to come by doing that. So these days, I think professionals, especially in the medical field, are much more careful about that, as well as the pharmacy piece. I think pharmacists and the Board of Pharmacy have got their heads around how to better monitor that. But the trends, I see it going both ways. I see more and more substance use disorder. I think it's growing. And I think because accessibility is there, kids are starting earlier. There are different types of ways to get loaded these days. It's not just the opiates. In fact, in Idaho, I'll just share this. 68% of my clients at Brickhouse Recovery are alcohol dependent. So we treat opiates for sure. But isn't it interesting that we've got this huge, massive issue with alcohol dependence, and we're not talking about the alcohol epidemic, are we? Mm. So that's just a little insight there.
Sounds like an episode of what we'd hear on talk radio. Jason, if we could go back to what you revealed about black tar heroin and dying, redlining, and they brought you back. And Tommy, maybe we could jump in with you on how you bring somebody back as being an ER doctor. How does that whole work for you? You're dead, but then they bring you back. Can you, do you remember anything about that experience or what it was like, pain or?
You know, I was out. I was blacked out. Worse than blacked out. I don't recall anything. I just woke up to being slapped a lot and water was being poured on my face. I wasn't being brought back by professionals. These were the guys that got me high, and they were so worried about me dying that they just all night slapped me around and dumped water on my head and put ice, you know, on me. And so they kept me alive. But had I gone to an ER, I think it would have played out a little different.
Yeah, we got a little Narcan. So what the good news and bad news is, those same receptors that the opioid attaches to, there's a medication called Narcan that has an affinity for those receptors that's much, much, much greater than the actual medication. So if you just give a little bit of the Narcan, either sublingually or injected, it will go immediately and displace all of the opioid off those receptors immediately. And if you want to see someone squirm, what happens is you get someone that's sat. So when you get too much heroin or Norco or Percocet in your body, what it causes is respiratory suppression. So what his colleagues were doing during the night is slapping him and reminding him to breathe, because otherwise he would have stopped breathing and died. Yep. And ultimately, once you don't breathe enough, you don't get enough oxygen to your heart and you have a code and then you die. So they were stimulating him to breathe, but if he would have been left alone, you would have died.
I would have.
But the minute you get EMS or you get to an ER, then you would get a dose of Narcan and immediately get better. But immediately now all those receptors are craving more of the opioid. It's the most uncomfortable I've ever seen. Patients are chronically addicted heroin users that come in overdosed, and you give them Narcan and they absolutely go berserk because now those receptors are all open and craving more opioid. But what a tragedy it is. I mean, I don't know how many times in my career I've seen people die, overdose, unfortunately. And then fortunately, a lot of times they come in and you give Narcan and they do well. But then they got to get treated for this, right? That's the next thing to talk about, because, and I'm glad you brought up alcohol too. I think a lot of times we're talking about the opioid crisis, but there's all sorts of addictions. And sometimes if you don't talk about that base addictive behavior, a lot of times people substitute one thing for the next thing, right? Maybe you can talk about that. So really it's getting to the heart of what's the underlying problem. I've got one question for you. I'm dying to ask you, because I was talking to a friend the other day who said that the millennials actually they're tracking their use of medication, depression, anxiety in their lives. And they're worried about a crisis that's coming with that next cohort, that they may be more likely to need help than even the prior generation were with addiction. Are you seeing that?
I am seeing an increase in mental illness symptoms and mental illness across the board as it relates to anxiety and depression in the adolescent and the millennial. I think they call the adolescents digitals. I think that's the proper term. I got to believe that a big reason why we're seeing that is because it's not just that they're on a lot of technology. I think it's because of systemic inflammation as it relates to overeating sugar, overeating refined starches, and lifestyle. And that creates a lot of depression and a lot of anxiety due to just lifestyle. In fact, just heard a professor, a PhD, give a lecture on this. His name is Dr. Jacob Hess. And it was all in relation to anxiety and depression. And this does relate to substance use disorder because it's like the chicken or the egg. If you've got anxiety or depression and you can take a pill to solve that, and you could take three pills to even feel better, or five pills or whatever, or drink alcohol and it goes away, then that's absolutely the direction people will go. So, but back to Dr. Hess, what he brought forth was, look, there are all these resources to read up on medications to treat anxiety and depression, particularly as we're seeing these numbers climb. He said, but I also want to point out that a lot of the research that we're reading is funded by those pharmaceutical companies that are pushing those medications. And so they will have 90% of the article on medication management and they'll have 10% on lifestyle. I said, let me show you a couple of other articles and a couple of other places to look and read and books to research. That's going to be more balanced, where medication is still very important, but also look at lifestyle. And I think that we've lost a lot of that, particularly with the millennial generation. And I'm like right on the cusp of millennial. A lot of us are entitled. A lot of us don't want to work hard. We want to kind of just be handed things. We want to get rich quick. We want to lose weight quick. We want to feel better quick. And we're impatient and we want that next quick fix. And when you have that kind of mentality, a lot of symptoms flare up. And I think we're seeing those symptoms flaring up.
I don't know the answer to this question or what you're going to say on this, so I can't wait to hear it. But, you know, we talk a lot and we hear a lot about marijuana, the legalization. And I think the reality of it is, we had Sheriff Gary Rainey on a couple months ago, and he basically said, listen, reality is, the minute the feds didn't do something about it, it's going to become legalized in the country. It's on its way there. And, you know, certainly in Idaho, we're surrounded now by states that it's right on our border. What's your take on marijuana? I'm very vocal that CBD oil is, we ought to be exploring and using that for what we use it for, but I'm not a medical marijuana guy, just because I've seen firsthand kind of how that's abused. And with that said, there's still probably some medical treatments for cancer and other things, for pain, where it's probably better than some of the other things. But, you know, there's certainly two arguments here. And one of the problems I have is sometimes you look at the source of those arguments, it's the same thing as who's funding the argument, right?
Right.
Who's got the money behind the deal? So right. What's your stance on it as someone that treats addiction? Is it something that worsens addiction and it's a gateway, or it's not, or it could replace some of the opioid problem if you had marijuana, which is not as addictive? Where are you on the whole medical marijuana thing?
Yeah, I can share my experience and keep it within that, because no one can argue with my experience, right? They can argue with my opinion, but
right.
My experience was, I was very much dependent on cannabis in Canada. And, you know, I smoked marijuana every day, all day for years as I went through college. And this was prior to this whole OxyContin ring. So I had a long history with cannabis. And, you know, I can tell you that it limited me in a lot of my development, a lot of my emotional development. It affected me mentally. I would forget things. Not just forget my keys or forget my wallet somewhere, but I would forget important memories and important things that I think are valuable. And I wish I would have cherished those. I see pictures now and I'm just like, man, I know I was stoned. I know I was stoned. And it's like, I wasn't even present for that. And it absolutely was, call it a gateway or not a gateway, it was an ascension. It was part of my ascension, and it was one of the earlier drugs that I used. And when kind of the fun wore off of that, I sought the next one to kind of fill that void that marijuana couldn't fill anymore. So that's my experience. And, you know, when I smell it, I love the smell. When I hear people talk about the wonderful medical benefits of CBD oil, I try not to project my substance use disorder on others. Like, I know I cannot use it or smoke it or associate with it, because I know that I have plans for Christmas, and all those plans will be off if I start using any drugs, any alcohol. And I want to remember my life, and I want to reach my potential. And that really did hold me back. So I think people get caught in the weeds, no pun intended.
I'll take the pun.
Kevin's loving this.
Yes, I am.
But that's where I stand, man.
You know, that's so well articulated too, I think, from someone that's got the experience, because I only know my experience, which is from treating lots of people over a long period of time. And it's similar to that, which is, you know, you might argue all you want that it's not that bad, it's this, that, and the other, but certainly messes people's lives up and doesn't let them fulfill their full potential. And that's a heck of a way to live, right? So,
well, we're going to hold the wall in Idaho, Tommy. Myself and Governor Little. I mean it. Anyway, Jason, if we could, this is all about inspiring folks. Could you share with us, for the purpose of helping people that may be down right now, your lowest point and how you took control of your life and brought yourself back?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a dark time that led up to that moment. And to kind of set the stage for it, I was going through my felony charges that ultimately came from being a part of that drug ring. And so I was given an option of drug court, and I was really struggling staying sober. So I was in and out of jail a lot. Was also losing jobs, getting jobs, working at cell phone stores, losing that job. And I had been divorced for a little while. So that's kind of the setting of the table of where I was at. I was in no position to take on what was about to happen. And one day I got a text message, and the text said, "Lisa's pregnant and the baby's yours." I panicked, and went through a lot of thoughts in my mind. And as I'm sharing this now, they're kind of coming through my mind. Again, but when he was born 9 months later, and I held him for the first time, something changed within me. I had been forced to get sober by the judge, and I was forced to get sober by the courts, and asked and pleaded by my parents and my ex-wife. And because it was someone else's will and their idea, I was pretty resistant to it. I just wasn't ready. But something happened as I watched my son fight for his life for 1 week behind that glass as I was in the hallway. And he had tubes in his mouth and oxygen on his nose, and his health was failing. And he fought for his life. It inspired me to fight for my own. And I went down into my car that my brother sold to me for a dollar. And I wrote him a letter on a legal pad of paper that made promises to him that I would turn my life around and I would become a man and a birth father that he could be proud of. And his health returned. And the next day we handed our, I handed my firstborn child into the arms of another family to raise and placed him for adoption. And although I didn't stay sober after that moment and I struggled for another couple of years, that promise I made to him in that letter was my why. That was what it was all about for me. And so I fought hard. Every day I tried to keep that promise. And when I'd fail, the shame would mount. But I ultimately did get sober in 2009, March 19th. And I just celebrated 10 years of sobriety. And you know what's cool is that I drove down to Salt Lake City in March. It was like March, right after I got my chip. And the chip is a little coin they give you at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings with a big Roman numeral X on it for 10 years. And I drove down to Salt Lake City and I got invited to watch one of his soccer games by his adoptive family, the Martins. And he scored a hat trick. So he got 3 goals in that game. And after the game, I got to pull him aside and he sat in the passenger seat of my car. And I got to give him that 10-year chip. And I got to have the first conversation with him that I've ever had by ourselves without other people around. And I got to tell him the reasons why I placed him for adoption. And that it wasn't because I didn't love him, but it was because I did love him. And I was in no place and in no shape to raise him. And I told him that he was my reason, that it was his birth that changed everything for me and gave me my reason to fight for my life. And then I asked him permission to share our story with the world to try to help and try to inspire. And he looked down the floor mat for a minute. And the book was already written. It's dedicated to him. And this story's in there. And I was like, I hope he doesn't say no, because it's already published, man. It's just not released. And he looked up at me and he said, let's do it. Let's tell our story to the world. And that is the answer to your question. That is what brought me out. It took a lot of effort to get sober. Recovery is not easy, but it's simple. It's simple. There's some simple practical applications on a daily basis that end up turning that boat around. And I'm grateful to be sitting here today, sober and happy, and have a beautiful relationship with my birth son.
Jason, thank you for sharing that. One of the things I really am proud of you on is just, how do you scale what's in here and get it out to affect more people? And so we were talking about a little bit before the podcast started today. I think this book starts that for you, right? It allows you to scale. And then I know you have an online program, because it's just too difficult, right? You have Brickhouse Recovery that helps people that can go be part of that, but how do you take what you've learned and this incredible knowledge and passion for helping people through this challenging time? And so tell us just a little bit about the book and then about the curriculum or the online program that's there, and how can listeners there find it if they have a loved one or someone that they know of that might benefit from this?
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully we can put the link in the show notes for the podcast for listeners to access it. But yeah, the book is exactly that. You said, how do you scale it? You know, I used to spend hours and hours and hours on the phone with family members who would ask me that question. How do I help my addicted loved one recover? And so I put it all in the book, and it took me 10 years. I mean, I started writing those things down early on when I got sober, just little messages I wanted to share with others after I had that hot dog grill experience with that father. And so 10 years later, here it is. And it's it's not just my story. I think that's important to point out. And the target audience of this book is for the influencer. It's for the mother, like my mom, when she found out that her son was strung out on Oxycontin. And she started to search online for resources, and she got, you know, she went down this rabbit hole of mediocre advice and opinions, and she didn't know where to turn. She wasn't ready to like go seek a therapist or go to like a support group or to reach out. She was very embarrassed and shell-shocked. And so she just wanted to read something or watch something in the privacy of her own home. And so this book is written for her. This is for those that are in my mom's situation, that they either just found out about their addicted loved one, or they've tried everything and it hasn't worked. Because the thing about the book is it's my story, but there are little vignettes of my story that really drive home the stages of change and what this first stage of change looks like, which is the denial stage, and how do you help someone out of denial? And then I give practical application there. And then I show the next stage, which is the contemplation stage, when they're ambivalent. Like, I still want to get high. I still love getting high. I still love my friends, but I don't like getting charged by the cops. I don't like what it's doing to my grade point average. I don't like what it's doing to my marriage, or whatever the case may be. And they're ambivalent, not ready to make change, but they're kind of waffling. And so how do you help someone get through that stage to get them ready to then take action? And so this book is a how-to guide, and I use my story and my parents' experiences and their wisdom of what they did do that didn't work and what they did that ultimately helped me transcend, so that it's something that as families read it, they can say, oh my gosh, I need to underline this because I'm going to apply this exact thing like tonight with my loved one. And then right on the heels of that, I've already had readers say, when's your course coming out? Because I want more. Like I want to do like a full thing. And so we produced a 12-week, it's called the Get Unhooked course for families. It's 12 weeks, 12 modules. And that is available in the same link that you can get the book. And I'm really excited about that because there's assignments. There's a DVD that comes with it. There's going to be a workbook that'll come with it, and a secret group that they can communicate with other family members that are in the same spot. So to be clear, this is all for the family members or for the employers that are trying to influence someone who has substance use disorder. This book isn't necessarily for the one addicted, if that makes sense.
Jason, what inspires you?
You guys. isn't that the best answer? What inspires me? Yesterday I had the honor and privilege of a backstage pass to the Miracle Show, watching five of my clients at Brick House Recovery graduate. When I see these principals work, it's a repeatable miracle show that I get to see over and over and over. And I realize that I'm not the only one that has access to this powerful process of recovery, that it's working today. And yesterday we graduated five, and that inspires me the most. That's what fills my cup, is when I see someone who's literally walking dead, and in a short period of time, the lights come back on. They've got hope. Their families are standing up and they're sharing about this transformation and how grateful they are that they have their loved one back. That's what inspires me.
Well, Jason, thank you for being here today. Just maybe one more personal note in closing. I want to personally thank you. I mean, you probably dread those late night calls from me, because in my life, just in my circle of my family, I've called you three times when I was desperate and said, hey, help me out. I got someone I love that needs some help. And I'll tell you what, three for three, you've said, let me take it from here. And you have absolutely changed their lives. So I've watched it work in action. And more important than maybe you helping me out, I've watched you help them out and really take them from a place of complete hopelessness, like literal hopelessness, no light, to back to where they were. And God bless you, because you have a gift. You have a gift that few have, and I hope that you can continue to share that gift because it blesses the lives of so many. And thank you so much for sharing it with us today.
You're so welcome. Thank you. I'd help you anytime, Tommy. You too, Kevin.
I appreciate it, Jason. I'll be calling you. I got a lot of issues. I want to thank everybody for listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast, and strive for excellence, everybody.
You've been listening to the Inspire Excellence Podcast. We invite you to find something that inspires you this week. Join us again for our next episode.